What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Tasha Robinson. I really felt quite distressed at not receiving an invitation.
You weren't wanted.
Not what? Oh dear, what an awkward situation. I had hoped it was merely due to some oversight. Well, in that event, I'd best be on my way.
You know, why don't you stick around, Tasha? I'd hate for you to put a curse on this week's top five Disney villains.
Oh, you'll get to the top five, Josh. But before you reach your number one, you'll prick your finger on that microphone and die.
Should be a fun show. Plus, our review of Angelina Jolie and Maleficent, that and more. Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM. And we're also brought to you by Harry's. They're a young, innovative company that's disrupting an industry that pretty much every guy listening to this show has had to pay into for years, razors. We all know how high-priced razor blades are at a grocery and drugstore. They're so expensive, it's even hard to get them. You have to get an employee to unlock them for you. Well, don't go with a cheap blade. As an alternative to that hassle, go with Harry's. For the first time, we can get a great shave at a fair price. Harry's was founded by two guys, Andy and Jeff, who knew there was a better way. They focus on giving guys a great shaving experience for a fraction of the price. It's half the price of other razor blades, such as Gillette. They have a clean product design. It's less but better. They have high-quality blades engineered in their own factory in Germany for sharpness and strength, plus the convenience and ease of ordering online so you can skip the razor aisle. I usually go with what Adam calls the 80s Don Johnson look. I wear the stubble for days, but Adam has to shave almost every day, and he always bemoans how fast he goes through blades and how expensive they are. Adam went to Harry's.com and ordered the engraved Winston set. It was shipped to his door. I know he loves the look and feel of this set. Gives him a great shave. He loves the price. Legitimately, he says it's the best shave he's ever had. So go to Harry's.com. That's Harry's.com. Use the offer code FILMSPOTTING to get $5 off your first purchase. That's Harry's.com. The promo code is FILMSPOTTING. We thank Harry's for their support of FILMSPOTTING. You're listening to Film Spotting with The Dissolve's Tasha Robinson sitting in for Adam this week. I'm Josh Larson. We may have to wait until Prince Adam returns in a week or two to lift the curse Tasha just put on this week's top five Disney villains. That's later in the show. First, Tasha and I weigh in on Angelina Jolie's interpretation of one of those classic Disney villains, Maleficent, if the horns fit.
I know who you are. You've been watching over me my whole life. I know you're there. Your shadow has been following me ever since I was small. Don't be afraid.
I'm not afraid.
Then come out.
Then you'll be afraid.
We're big on fairy tales in my house, Tasha, the Disney variations of them in particular. So the family went out on opening night to see Maleficent, Disney's wickedification of its own Sleeping Beauty. As with Broadway's Wicked, this is a familiar tale from the villain's point of view. Here, that of the bad fairy who curses the princess in the original Sleeping Beauty. In a story scripted by Linda Wolverton and directed by first-timer Robert Stromberg, we learn of the trauma that led Maleficent, played by Angelina Jolie, to turn to her evil ways. Aside from some curiosity and a slight hopefulness due to the visuals from the trailer, I'll admit I wasn't expecting much, to the point that I didn't bother to bring my notebook to the theater. Are you a note-taker, Tasha?
Oh, I'm an inveterate note-taker.
Okay.
I can't even watch a film for fun without taking notes, just in case.
See, I'm usually that way, too. In this instance, I thought, you know what, let's just do that. Let's just try, go out to the movie with the family for a bit of fun. But then the film started. And I really
just started
liked
taking notes.
It was a little instinctual, I'll admit. But I also really liked the opening language that the voiceover narration has. Let us tell an old tale anew to see how well you know it. I thought, that's good. I'll have to remember that in case I want to refer to it. Then more interesting things began to happen story-wise until about 20 minutes in, I was nudging my wife, hoping she had a pen and maybe some paper that I could grab. It turns out that Maleficent did make me think about the Sleeping Beauty fairy tale in some intriguing new ways, and I did more scribbling than I ever would have guessed. I'll elaborate in a minute on why I did that, but I want to hear about your experience, Tasha. Did Maleficent provoke new thoughts for you, or did your notebook remain sadly blank?
Oh, it certainly provoked some new thoughts for me, but it definitely wasn't that first 20 minutes. That was actually the biggest hurdle for me to get over.
With the young Maleficent?
No, not with the young Maleficent. With the opening of now we're going to have what I call extra explainy voiceover for 5 minutes or so where we tell you in great detail what the setup of this story is. I really wished that more of that could have been seen on the screen instead of explained to us. Now, there's a long theme of Disney stories that begin with a book opening or with that kind of narration of we're sitting you down and telling you a story because it's a fairy tale and that's how fairy tales are told. But even so, like from a modern filmmaking standpoint, it always trips me up when we launch into narration like that.
I think that's fair. And I've launched that complaint against other films as well. This oftentimes it's the mythology of a movie or of a series that trips me up when they spend time explaining that. So I'm certainly sympathetic to that criticism, but I was captured from the start here. I think part of it was understanding how it did play into that Disney tradition. And part of it was just being interested in these two kingdoms they set apart. I felt like the explanation was necessary here to the degree that they are twisting this tale a little bit, and we need to have our bearings because what we're bringing to the theater most likely is our understanding of the 1959 Disney version. And what the filmmakers here are setting up is this human kingdom and this fairy kingdom or fantastic kingdom that's largely self-governed. They have Maleficent who keeps a watch on things but isn't really in charge, whereas the human kingdom has, of course, a greedy king. And here's where I started to see the primary theme of this film or this take on the legend form in a way that compelled me. Mostly, this considered Sleeping Beauty through the lens of patriarchal oppression, which other Disney films have done here and there.
Certainly.
I think this one really tackles it in an interesting way in that we understand how this one fairy tale figure's whole identity has been formed as the result of rapacious men and as the result of her response to them. And so having this one king set up who wants to take over the fairyland, and initially Maleficent helps her creatures to repel him, yet that opens the door for this other character, Stefan, played by Charlton Copley, to want to weasel his way into Maleficent's heart because the king says, the one who brings me the head of Maleficent will inherit my throne. So we have this theme of greed and usurping, the extending of power to take over things that the movie really followed through with in interesting ways, I thought.
Although you also have a theme of betrayal because Stefan doesn't weasel his way into her heart once he gets the idea to bring her a trophy from her back to the king and claim his kingdom. He knows her from childhood.
Mm-hmm.
They have a long relationship. They share what seems to be, at least for her, a first kiss together, which he tells her is the kiss of true love. They have an existing relationship. And he makes the conscious decision to destroy that relationship, to betray her in a very painful, intimate, personal way for power. And that intimate, personal way basically plays out as a rape metaphor.
It does.
I mean, he sits down holding her in his arms and then he drugs her and physically violates her and takes something precious from her and takes it away as a trophy. And I think there's a heavy symbolism in there of Snow White, you know, of the huntsman taking Snow White into the forest and then coming home with a bloody trophy to give to the queen to prove that she's dead. That's sort of the same story there. But there's a relationship between them and a sense of intimacy that's what he is very consciously giving up and leaving her tortured and torn and an entirely new person just consumed with a desire for revenge.
That scene between Copley and Maleficent is really shocking. I found it to be not that it's explicit at all, but the fact that this is
being marketed as a family film. It's PG. Not that other PG family films haven't had disturbing things in them, but this one,
I mean,
Disney in general.
When we get into the top five, there are a lot of things in there that, like looking at them again with adult eyes, there's there's a lot of darkness in fairy tales. It's almost inevitable. But some of the things Disney kind of slips in under the radar of children for adults are simply astonishing.
And along those lines, in those terms, this isn't really under the radar. At least it didn't strike me as that. It was pretty blatant and I thought very effective. For one thing, what I liked about it is it alluded back to an earlier version of this tale, even earlier than the Brothers Grimm from Giambattista Basile, which would be the 17th century, that does include sexual assault as part of the legend. So this is a tradition that the movie is harking back to, and it's not just something they throw in there of the moment or to generate drama. So I like that part about it, even though it's a very distressing scene. I also appreciated how it does reposition Maleficent in a crucial way. In our modern terms, she's now a trauma victim. And I thought it was compelling to watch her decisions, her actions, from that point on, how she begins to process what has happened to her in these grand terms. And I think this gets to the question for me that a lot of people have asked is, do we need this film? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, why is this around? Yes, it's clearly a product of Disney. They're looking to milk a franchise, mm-hmm. obviously. That's what they've always done.
Sure.
And so to a degree, if someone had asked me if I needed a Maleficent film, I probably would have said no. That being said, it's been made.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't hold it to a higher standard because I didn't necessarily need it. But what we've been given, I think, is something that exists to a purpose. Revisionist fairy tales are often marketing ploys, just bald grabs for money. But I think this revision, it's been revised to a purpose.
Well, I mean, revisionist fairy tales are very often each age kind of remakes the fairy tales for their own purposes, for their own the ideals of the time. I mean, even back when the Grimm brothers were collecting and codifying these things, they modified them for their own. Wilhelm Grimm was apparently a huge misogynist, and a lot of the morals that worked into these things about evil stepmothers and evil witches, the woman is always the bad guy, which we mm-hmm. see carried over into Disney pretty effectively. And the father figure is always sort of ineffectual. And the mother figure is usually gone. And you have a girl trying to navigate this sort of image of strong and evil womanhood. That was stuff that the Grimms inserted into existing fairy tales. And then as you have like more and more modern versions, they change for the times as well. You know, I went in pretty doubtful because it seemed to me to be a really blatant attempt to remake Wicked and to kind of get the attention and money that Wicked got. But I found it really ending up being an interesting exercise in the sense that since the 90s, since the Disney Renaissance, effectively, they've been making movies as correctives to their own past, because the Disney classic era was so full of basically clashes between unattractive but powerful women with agency who had to be destroyed and these naive little pretty princess girls who made choices for themselves only until the man came along and then the man would rescue them. And they took a lot of crap for it in the 80s and early 90s. So then you had like each new story, you know, Beauty and the Beast brought in Belle. And at the time, Disney marketed that very heavily as here's a clash between an arrogant man and an independent woman. And then more and more of the Disney princesses, like right up until Frozen, are rescuing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So this is part of that revisionist history. It is, I think it was made extremely consciously to, you know, give this really elegant and cruel and frightening and exciting and interesting villain depth as well as evil.
And do you see that as mercenary, as a marketing tactic, or do you see that as an interesting corrective that's maybe needed and is done in a good way? Because I'm more in the latter camp when it comes to Maleficent.
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
Disney has also, I mean, both of those things are entirely true. Disney has always mixed the mercenary, like playing to the audience, manipulating the audience, like back to the Disney days. It's been very conscious of marketing, very conscious of presentation, very conscious of how it plays an audience. But it's mixed that with some really elegant and sophisticated and beautiful art. Walt Disney was a showman, and he had a lot of experience in drawing out what moved people emotionally, what made them care. That doesn't obviate the art.
Well, well. What a glittering assemblage, King Stefan. Royalty, nobility, the gentry, and... How quaint. Even the rebel.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson here with Tasha Robinson from The Dissolve. We're reviewing Maleficent, the new Disney revisionist fairy tale starring Angelina Jolie. And we haven't even gotten to Jolie yet, which seems to be the point of response for most early audiences. Largely positive. I think even those who didn't appreciate the film overall thought that she worked here. She certainly worked for me. I think she internalized this heavy, heavy psychology that the film gives her in the first maybe half hour or so and manages to project that in a performance that's big, theatrical. I don't think she ever turns to camp as sort of an escape route to give her an excuse to go bigger. Does a lot of work with her eyes.
And her mouth. My
See,
God.
Her mouth. I mean, it's a facial performance. It's almost a silent movie performance, except for one great soliloquy about what she did lose in that one scene with Stefan. I think that's a really good speech. But yeah, it's mainly a facial performance. And I think it works. I mean, even the fact that her accent is, you know, a little bit British, a lot Joan Crawford, maybe. Mm-hmm. Even that for me, in the context of things worked. Again, this persona of Maleficent as a trauma victim, she's trying on a role here.
Oh, yes.
She's trying on the role of villainess and seeing, is this how I'm going to go ahead with my life now that this has happened to me? So the fact that it's theatrical and maybe a little odd here and there worked for me.
It's a little drag queeny.
It is.
There's very much a sense. And that's what I loved about her performance. In your review on Larson on Film kind of called out the fact that her performance is very layered. And that was pretty much, I would say, my favorite thing about the movie was her visual appearance. They do an amazing job of making her look, both giving her her own look and making her look like the original character. But the performance itself, I think there's a real sense of this, something has been done to me that I couldn't control. So now I'm going to try out control and I'm going to try on these various layers of costume and see how they work. And it's not just the visual costume. It's let's try on rulership and see if that helps. Let's try on intimidation and see if that helps. Let's try bullying and see if that helps. And you see her pick up each of these things one at a time in the same way she picks up her iconic things from the original movie, her staff and her raven and her cloak. Each of these things is just the layer that she's putting on, and watching that all come together, I think was just chilling.
Now, how did you feel about the visuals otherwise, outside of Jolie? Because that's one of the things I think people have been a little harder on, the effects. I think your great line in your Dissolve review is that this entire world of the Moors where Maleficent lives, might as well call it Uncanny Valley, I think you said. And you're right there. I think there are some effects, particularly the three fairies who turn human later in the film. And when we first meet them, they're kind of superimposed human faces.
I hate those things so much.
Yeah, they're almost as creepy as Olaf for me from Frozen. I mean, I'm not going to get over them. But it didn't derail the picture for me. Otherwise, what did you think of the visual design here?
It derailed the picture
really?
A little bit for me.
It was that distracting?
It was extremely distracting, I think. The attempt to shrink down the faces of the human actors playing the three pixies and superimpose them onto these CGI creations. Robert Strongberg, the director, did visual effects for Avatar, for Alice in Wonderland, for Oz the Great and Powerful. And all of those movies are kind of these, you know, candy-colored CGI masterpiece monstrosities. I mean, just these really, really garish kind of places crowded to the brim with detail. Mm-hmm. And I really see that here. The Uncanny Valley where they live is just so visually overblown and garish. And it just didn't seem like a fantasy wonderland I would want to be in. Later in the film, when Maleficent develops a relationship with Aurora, the girl that she's cursed, they spend a lot of time hanging out in, I'm just going to think of it as the Uncanny Valley. Mm-hmm. And Aurora takes up the profession of standing there looking cute and extending her hand to various CGI beasties. They repeat that motif over and over and over. You know, the flying thing, the the croaking thing, the mud-flinging thing will all come to your hand, because that's how Disney princesses work, is they kind of summon in the cute little animals that frolic around them. And in this case, they're all CGI creatures. But all, none of that felt nearly as real to me as just the images of Jolie posing, essentially, just standing and overlooking her kingdom, overlooking Aurora, overlooking the evil that she's created. There's just a shallow, sugary falsity to so much of it that really bothered me.
I'll grant you some of that. And I do wonder also, a lot of that depends on something happening with the actors amidst all of this glut of CGI wonder, because there's a ton of it. You're right. And I wonder if Stromberg, being a first-time director, maybe is still learning the facility of how to get an actor to bring something to that rather than just having them pose. I think Jolie is strong enough and such a striking presence that she can do it. But some of the supporting characters, including Elle Fanning as Aurora, they don't really know what to do while they're standing there amidst this. And the three fairies as well, there's some ill-advised comic relief that doesn't quite work. Again, I wonder if you had an experienced director with actors, might be able to find a way to massage those. But there are other visual elements for me that worked beyond Jolie. And you alluded to one. When she first decides, all right, I'm going all villain here, she goes marching back into the moors. And maybe you would especially appreciate this, because suddenly all of that CGI fantasia starts to get dimmed, because she literally trails a cloud, a shadow with her. And the whole land goes dark. And this fantastic island of sentient flowers and jumping fish beasties, it goes dark, and thorns come up and create this throne for her. And suddenly she's claimed it, right? Mm-hmm. As she's claiming this identity, she claims this land. I thought that was very effective. And there are also little touches, just throwaway things. In the climactic battle, Maleficent and Stefan face off. And during the chaos, they find themselves attached by the same iron chain. Mm-hmm. And we learn early on that iron burns Maleficent. So this is burning her as it's attached to her. He's caught on it too. And I just thought it was a wonderful symbol for this circle of hatred and pain that they've each brought upon each other. Him as the instigator, obviously. That worked visually as well. So I did find enough of those to realize that Stromberg was bringing some interesting things from his visual effects past to this film.
I loved that conclusion. A lot of people that I've read have been down on it because she doesn't turn into a big purple dragon, which was such an iconic image in the first movie. But I didn't want this movie to repeat every beat from the first movie. You know, you got your dragon. It wasn't her, but you got your dragon.
Right.
Like, what more do you want? What I found far more interesting about that sequence and what made it work for me is that so much of it is accomplished without dialogue. In a sequence where normally you would have the two of them facing off and airing their grievances at length and posturing and threatening each other, he says something to the effect of, you know, what's it like now, you know, for you to be isolated and not fit in anywhere, which is manifestly unfair given that he's the one that put her in that position in the first place. But apart from that, they don't much talk to each other. They both know why they're there. They both know what they want. It's not necessary. And I respected that hugely. There are a bunch of different moments in the movie where they just do away with dialogue entirely. And I think that makes it far more iconic than it would have been otherwise. One of the reasons that all of the narration at the beginning bothered me was because it was so talky and so exposition-y. So many other sequences in the movie just do away with that entirely. And I love it.
As far as recreating beat for beat from the earlier Disney film, there is one scene that almost does that, and I think it actually works. I agree with you that that is a virtue of the climax, that it doesn't try to mimic it. But the curse scene where Maleficent comes into the throne room, Stefan is king by now, has a child, and threatens to put the curse on her, the Princess Aurora. I love that.
I
thought it was great. Again, not only because Jolie pulls it off, right? That's probably the signature scene for this performance, but also, again, because how it ties in with this idea of the trauma victim. The one touch, and there is a little bit of dialogue here, but it's thematic. It works, is when she offers the out, right, that this legend has had. If she receives true love's kiss, she will be freed from this eternal sleep. And the way Jolie plays it, and again, seeing how Maleficent has been positioned, that isn't a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's a twisting of the knife mm-hmm. into Stefan, because she knows that true love is what cursed her in a certain way. And here she's just throwing that back in his face. So that, and also the visual elements that recall the 59 Sleeping Beauty that are in that scene work as well. I mean, that 59 film, man, the production design, it was a 70mm animated film, and the way they filled that frame, it's such a beautiful movie visually that I'm glad they brought some touches of that back to this new Maleficent.
Oh, sure. I mean, you mentioned the moment where she comes back into her kingdom and takes it over consciously as its ruler, and it starts to darken. But when she goes, every time she goes to Stefan, his kingdom is completely dark. I mean, it's like it's a visual representation of what he's done to get there. And when she walks into the throne room to curse Aurora, the place is bleak and black and just and heavy with anger and despair. And that's even before she throws a curse down on it. That sequence where she's basically saying the lines from the 1959 original, I thought was absolutely fantastic. When she smiles and her mouth turns into that vast, frightening cartoon Joker mouth, again, from the original, I thought, is there CGI involved in
yeah.
this? Because, you know, she's wearing prosthetic cheekbones. She's wearing prosthetic pointy ears. She's wearing false eyes to give her that kind of cat's eye feel. I still don't know whether they did something to her mouth, because she looks in that moment so much like the cartoon, and I thought it was fantastic. But that scene diverges from the original, not just when she gives him the out, but before that, when she basically says, "Kneel to me," and humiliates him in front of his entire court. And he does it, but apparently because he cares about his child. The big flaw for me in Maleficent, the movie, I think, is the fact that he's so underdeveloped, that you know so little about who he is and what he wants and how he relates to. Does he care about his wife? He doesn't care when she dies. Does he care about his child? He doesn't care when she shows up again. But in that moment, she knows that she has him where she wants him, and she takes full advantage of it. And that's where the fairy tale is just sort of grabbed and twisted, you know, to be, again, about female power and male betrayal and where it's going to go between them from there.
Another instance of usurping of power, certainly. Well, Maleficent is currently out in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our review here, email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We'd also love to hear a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or you can find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at facebook.com/Filmspotting. Well, if you thought Tasha's acting was good at the start of the show, wait until you hear her next in Massacre Theater. No pressure there, Tasha. Then we'll share our list of the top 5 Disney villains. Stay with us.
Trust in me, just in me. Shut your eyes and trust in me. Hold still, please. You can sleep safe and sound, knowing I am around. Slip into silent slumber, sail on a silver mist. Slowly and surely your senses will cease to resist. Trust in me.
Quick reminder here that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what they're paying now, go to harrys.com and get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code FILMSPOTTING when you check out. We're also brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM. We heard from a listener, Christopher Redman, who has used Squarespace, wanted to share his experience. Hey there, Film Spotters. Christopher says, we wanted to let you know that based on Film Spotting's recommendation, the DearCastAndCrew.com was built on Squarespace. As a concept-based film website where every review is written as a letter to someone who worked on the film, customization was key to building our brand. Squarespace has been very easy to use and allowed us to coordinate with over a dozen regular film reviewers around the world. It also lets our readers easily navigate the 300-plus reviews posted in the past 2 years. Best of all, we have a big website redesign coming in the next couple of weeks, so we encourage film spotting listeners to check out DearCastAndCrew.com now if you haven't already, and come back again soon to see all the incredible possibilities with Squarespace. As I'm sure Christopher has experienced, Squarespace is constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. They have beautiful designs for you to start with and all the style options you need to create a unique website for you or your business. The new Squarespace Metric app for iPhone and iPad also allows you to check site stats like page views, unique visitors, and social media follows. With the blog app, you can make text updates, tap and drag images to change layouts, and monitor comments on the go. You can also easily embed videos and trailers of your favorite films and TV shows via the simple YouTube and Vimeo integration. It's incredibly easy to use, but if you do want some help, Squarespace has an amazing support team. They work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This all starts at just $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. To get started, though, you don't need a credit card. Just start building your website. Then when you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM to get 10% off and to show your support for film spotting. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Shut your eyes and trust.
Mother.
I leave my sister here.
Now, do not worry. She's going to get the best medical care available. Do you have a place to stay?
No. Do you know somewhere?
Yeah, I know a place. If you'd like, I can take you there. Yes?
Yes.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Tasha Robinson. I'm Josh Larson. That was Joaquin Phoenix and Marion Cotillard in a clip from The Immigrant. We were planning a review of director James Gray's acclaimed new film for this week's show, and we'll get to it next week. But with Adam away, it was a good excuse to have you back on the show, Tasha, especially for a review of Maleficent and a Disney-related top five. You love animation, maybe even more than I do, and we will start that top five here in just a bit. But first, a few notes. Regarding Adam not being with us this week, family obligations are keeping him from the show for possibly a couple of weeks. We just ask at this point that you keep him and his family in your thoughts as we are here on the show. We do look forward to having him back when the time is right. And that means, yes, he'll get a chance to deride me for my love of Maleficent. You can count on that. Speaking of deriding me, bonus content, which is available to subscribers to the Film Spotting app. This week, I'm going to keep Tasha around for a few minutes for some X-Men talk. Michael Phillips and I weren't able to generate much enthusiasm for Days of Future Past on the show last week, much to the chagrin of some of you out there. We'll respond to some listener feedback, voicemails, and we'll also get Tasha's more positive take on the film. More information about bonus content is at filmspotting.net. Just click apps. Also at filmspotting.net, our current poll question has us asking about a best-selling YA novel that's been adapted into one of this weekend's big releases, The Fault in Our Stars. We may or may not get to a review of the film next week. I know I do want to see it, but that is when we'll discuss the poll results. You can vote now over at filmspotting.net. Tasha, you saw The Fault in Our Stars, I believe, just last night.
I did.
Can you give us an early impression of it?
Well, my first impression was that it's essentially John Green's best-selling YA novel put on screen, which often adaptations take a very, very liberal hand with their content, and especially with something as sensitive as this. I mean, the story is about two teenagers who are both dying of cancer. Well, one is a survivor who lost his leg. One has severe damage to her lungs. Both of them kind of share this aesthetic of kind of living in the moment because they know, you know, they could die at any time. And it's a very, very sensitive subject. But it's handled, I think, beautifully, both in the book and in the film. The performances are really terrific, really engrossing. And I really think that the director, Josh Boone, hits a very, very careful mark in between a sense of sentiment and a sense of uplift. He manages to like evoke some of their emotions without wallowing in them. And he kind of captures that really wry, dark, but still kind of playful sense of humor that people get during tragedies. I think it's really well done.
Well, Shailene Woodley is the lead there, so sounds promising. I'm looking forward to seeing it. Now, Tasha, the real reason you agreed to do this show, Massacre Theater. We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this scene.
Free as a bird, apparently. You go everywhere you want with whomever. That much freedom could maybe get a fellow into trouble. What do you think?
I'd like my keys.
Could it be you don't remember me?
Oh, yeah, sure. I remember you. You were at the movie house the other night.
Oh, I'm disappointed. I'm hurt.
I would like the keys.
Max Cady. You look the same. Maybe 15 pounds heavier. But they say the average man gains a pound a year until he's about... Gains a pound a year till he's about 60. Me, I dropped a pound every year of my sentence.
Leonard, 77.
You got it, July. 14 years since I held a set of K's.
That was Robert De Niro as Max Cady and Nick Nolte as Sam Bowden in Martin Scorsese's 1991 remake of Cape Fear. It was written by Wesley Strick, based on J.D. McDonald's novel The Executioners, and James Webb's screenplay for the 1962 original. The tie-in? Well, this goes back to the ongoing tattoo saga we've been having on the show lately. A couple of episodes back on 491, Adam and I reviewed Godzilla, and we shared the top five movie tattoos that we would get. Not tattoos in movies like the kind De Niro sports in Cape Fear, but the movie-related quotes, images, etc., that we would have tattooed onto our bodies. It was a really fun top five that has so far not resulted in any new ink, at least for me. To hear that episode, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or listen to the show at filmspotting.net. Tasha, you knew we were going to ask you this, with this being an ongoing question. Michael Phillips fessed up. Your movie tattoo, maybe that's something we can share in bonus content this week?
Oh, we'll get there.
All right. Looking forward to it. Well, we do have a winner for that Cape Fear Massacre Theater. Tasha, will you do the honors and pick the name out of the hat?
All right. This week, the hat is a black latex shroud with big long horns on it. Reaching into the Maleficent Film Spotting hat, we have... Patrick Madigan of Chicago.
Congratulations, Patrick. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your Film Spotting t-shirt.
The other day, when I heard Mr. Fabian tell Miss Channing that her understudy was going to have a baby, and they'd have to replace her.
And you want to be Margaret's new understudy?
I don't let myself think about it even.
It is time for Massacre Theater this week. We are going to change the names. We'll just say we're doing that to protect the integrity of the segment. There's also a special effect here, and we've brought in props before for special effects, Tasha. I don't think that would be wise in this case, so I'm going to try to do this sound with my mouth, Police Academy style. We'll see how that works out. I'm going to lead off the scene here, so Tasha, please give me the action.
And action.
No stopping me this time, Valiant. This is it. Don't make a move, Valiant. Not a step. My finger's on the trigger. Don't try to stop me, Valiant.
Oh, not again.
This is it. Don't try to stop me this time, Valiant. Don't try to stop me this time. Don't you dare try to stop me this time, Valiant. Try to stop me. Valiant, you'd better get up off your ass. Get over here, Valiant.
I'm coming. I'm coming.
Stop me. This is not a joke. I'm committing suicide. Don't ever frighten me like that again.
I'm sorry.
What are you, some kind of a sadist?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. How do you feel now?
I want to die.
Oh, now, now.
There's no adventure here.
You call this no adventure?
Death is the only adventure I have left, Valiant.
And scene.
Scene. Wonderful work. I know for sure, Tasha, you're going to be getting my midnight call. If I need consolation, you did such a good job in that scene. So expect that sometime soon. If you know what scene we just massacred, email the title along with your name and location to feedback at filmspotting.net. You have a little time here. The deadline is Monday, June 16. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the show in 2 weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
What are y'all doing? Running back to your kid? He don't want you no more.
That's a lie.
Is it? Tell me this, Sheriff. If your kid loves you so much, why is he leaving? You think you're special, cowboy? You're a piece of plastic. You were made to be thrown away. Speak of the devil.
You've had the first half of the show now to come up with your top five Disney villains. And now we tell you that Pixar films don't count. Toy Story's Lotso Huggin' Bear, as you heard in that clip, brilliantly voiced by Ned Beatty, certainly would have made my top five if they were eligible, but we're sticking with Disney proper for this list. We've also excluded live-action Disney films, so no Mr. Banks from Mary Poppins, for instance, or Jeffrey Rush's Barbossa from Pirates of the Caribbean either. Tasha, aside from those restrictions we had talked about, were there any other criteria you kept in mind? And basically, how did you go about forming this list?
You know, I just went with my gut on these, I have to say. I didn't really have any special criteria because I didn't really need them. I mean, Disney villains is a relatively small subset. What I found that interested me, though, was once I actually had my list, they have so much in common. And I think what they have in common more than anything else is a heady, delicious sort of shamelessness. They're all fundamentally hypocrites, but they're hypocrites in a glorious, outsized way. They're all heavily tempered by self-justification and self-justification that they put in a very aggressive way onto their victims, onto the heroes of these movies, in order to manipulate them or in order to deny any sort of involvement with their own villainy. The more I think about it, the more I look at Disney villains, one of the things that seems to mark them apart from other villains in general is just this feeling of self-righteousness and justification that I think is pitched on a level that even little kids can get. Even little kids can tell that these people, when they say, "I'm a good guy, I'm on your side, I just want to help you," they can tell that they're lying.
That's good. That's good. And I certainly saw some recurring qualities in the characters once I looked back on my list, too. So definitely some weird things going on when it comes to Disney characters, villains in particular, and what those are communicating to kids and the adults as well. All right. So let's get into it then. What is your number five?
My number five is Madame Medusa from The Rescuers. She's voiced by Geraldine Page. She is... There are a long tradition of Disney villains who are unattractive women, and Disney took a lot of flack for this, as I said, in the 90s in particular, for this history of the heroine always looks more or less the same, but the villain is always horrifically skinny or horrifically fat or, you know, slovenly or disorganized or whatever. Madame Medusa is all of these things put into just one glorious, over-the-top package.
Snoops, you don't have a way with children. You must gain their confidence, make them like you.
Yeah? How do you do that?
You force them to like you, idiot! At the next,
she is one of the few Disney villains that doesn't have any kind of song, because The Rescuers is not a musical. But she just kind of brings across this glorious frumpiness. There's a sequence in The Rescuers where she puts on her face, and you get to see both what she looks like without makeup, which is terrible, and what she looks like with makeup, which is terrible. But what makes her fun and what makes her an amazing villain is her perfect willingness to kidnap an orphan child, manipulate that orphan child up one side and down the other, you know, tell her nobody is ever going to love you, so you might as well do what we say, or I will feed you to my pet crocodiles. And then she sends her down into a cave to retrieve a gem, repeatedly risking her life. She has no sense of morality whatsoever, but she's so much larger than life. I mean, all of these Disney villains are larger than life, but Madame Medusa for me is larger than life in just a particularly, as I say, shameless and hilarious and oversized way.
And that ability to manipulate. Manipulation is certainly a reoccurring theme when you look at Disney villains, specifically for my number five, actually, which is Mother Gothel from Tangled. Tangled is sort of my Frozen, I would say. It's the recent Disney princess musical that I think can be mentioned in the same breath as some of its early classics. I still get dirty looks in my house for not being gaga over Frozen, but there's just something about the structural discipline to Tangled that appeals to me more. And the movie also has to its great advantage Mother Gothel, voiced by Tony Award-winning actress Donna Murphy. In this version of the Rapunzel story, Mother Gothel is a witch who kidnapped Rapunzel as a baby and kept her captive for the restorative power of her magic hair. So Rapunzel's hair keeps Gothel young. I've mentioned Mother Gothel before on the show, possibly in the top five hostage movies list that Adam and I made, and I talked about how she works as a vain housewife of Fairy Tale Hills, hooked on this magical form of plastic surgery. It struck me watching it again that she's also a stand-in for that type of parent, the over-controlling helicopter parent that we see these days, the kind that might give a few thoughts to locking their kids up in a tower. She certainly works to that degree as well. So there's some contemporary relevance here to this character, but really this is mostly a clever variation on the passive-aggressive parent-child relationship, which has probably been going on since the beginning of time, always been with us. I love the one line when Gothel tells Rapunzel, "You know, I hate leaving you after a fight, especially when I've done nothing wrong." I mean, we've heard variations of that and possibly said them as well. Like most of the Disney villains on this list, Mother Gothel also gets a grand musical number right in line with this, Mother Knows Best. So Mother Gothel from Tangled, she's my number five.
Mother knows best, one way or another, something will go wrong, I swear. Ruffians, thugs, poison ivy, quicksand, cannibals and snakes, the plague.
No!
Yes!
But also large bugs, men with pointy teeth, and stop no more, you'll just upset me. Mother's right here. Mother will protect you.
And Mother Knows Best is such a fantastic song, but the moment where she just crams every possible excuse she can to keep Rapunzel down home on the farm, basically, I mean, up in the tower. You know, there are bad people out there and they'll kill you. And besides, you're not equipped and you're clumsy and you're looking a little fat, dear.
It just slips that in,
just,
right?
Just shoves that in there. And then the reprise when she comes back and manipulates her again by saying, no, go ahead, dear, do whatever you want. Oh, it's brilliant.
Yeah, pretty evil. All right, what do you have for number four, Tasha?
Well, I'm sure the rest of your list is, you know, impressive and villainous and interesting and all, but I don't even know why you bothered, because give five hurrahs, give 12 hip hips. Gaston is the best, and the rest are all drips. Gaston from Beauty and the Beast is, as I said earlier in the show, is kind of a corrective for a long string of female Disney villains. He's handsome, he's strong, he's a Disney hero. He just happens to be incredibly arrogant. And there is a really weird sense of sexual menace to him. He is so determined to have Belle solely because she's beautiful. He has decided that because she's the most beautiful, they belong together. What she wants doesn't matter. What anybody else wants doesn't matter. So he is willing to have her father committed in order to force her to marry him. He is willing to kill her existing boyfriend. He's basically willing to do anything. And that comes up both in his song and in the reprise of his song when his buddy LeFou basically says, no one plots like Gaston, takes cheap shots like Gaston, plans to persecute harmless crackpots like Gaston. I love his sheer malevolence. But I also, again, love that he's kind of this Disney. The Disney corrective thing may seem too politically correct to some. To me, it just means we get a bigger variety of villains. So he's a villain that we haven't seen before. And of course, he's a villain who has his own song dedicated to how wonderful he is, which is an immensely catchy song full of a lot of really fun lines.
In a spitting match, nobody spits like Gaston.
I'm especially good at Expecto Rating. When I was a lad, I ate 4 dozen eggs every morning to help me get large. And now that I'm grown, I eat 5 dozen eggs, so I'm roughly the size of a barge.
I've always had a soft spot for Gaston because I, too, use antlers in all of my decorating. But he does bring up an interesting point, which I wrestled with for this list. I don't know if you did, but a lot of times for our top fives, you have to go out of your way because of the history of cinema to include women, just because of how women have been depicted in film. It was the reverse here, mm-hmm. right? Disney, to your point about these women figures, gives us plenty of them to choose from. So Gaston, good representation of the men here for this list. My number four is going to be the original Maleficent from 1959, Sleeping Beauty. I said that what I appreciated about the new Maleficent is that it did add things to the 59 character, but that wasn't because I thought the original was necessarily lacking. This Maleficent is one of Disney's most purely terrifying personifications of evil. There's not a lot of that shading, which is good, that we've talked about so far in this character. She is just... her devilishness is so pure, it's almost a virtue.
Listen well, all of you. The princess shall indeed grow in grace and beauty, beloved by all who know her. But before the sun sets on her 16th birthday, she shall prick her finger on the spindle of a spinning wheel and die.
Oh, no.
Seize that creature!
Stand back, you fools!
The voice comes from Eleanor Audley, who was also the wicked stepmother in Disney's Cinderella. There's a wicked purr in her voice, and Audley gives it this regal villainy, which I think is another recurring Disney trait. The visual design to this character is just so ingenious. Thorns play a prominent role in the Sleeping Beauty story, and Maleficent herself is all spiky and sharp angles from her horns to her eyebrows to her chin. And when she does transform into the dragon in that climax, the movie takes full advantage of that widescreen 70mm format. The jaws, they nearly fill the screen, and then every last inch around them is choked by these brambles. Considering the bland prince in this scene and even the bland Sleeping Beauty, right? It seems like all the artistry and ingenuity went into the villain. The new Maleficent is really just an extension of that from the original.
Sure. And she's more developed and she has more of a backstory. She has more of a like a sense of personhood. But the original is terrifying. She is a literal demon. And just before she transforms into a dragon, she says, "Now you face me and all the forces of hell."
Yes.
She openly evokes the fact that she's basically a demon in human form.
Pretty creepy. We'll finish our lists of the top five Disney villains when we come back, including one from Tasha I had never heard of. A deep Disney cut is next. Stay with us.
He don't take no time to play. Time to play. Time to play. All he does is work all day.
You can play and laugh and fiddle. Don't think you can make me sore. I'll be safe and you'll be sorry when the wolf comes to your door.
Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? Big bad wolf, big bad wolf. Who's afraid of the big bad wolf?
All you listeners over at the Film Spotting Mothership, Allison Wilmore here from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. And in our latest episode, Matt Singer and I look back wistfully at our radical pasts while trying to embrace our capitalist present as we discuss Lawrence Kasdan's The Big Chill.
We'll also take a look at some other films about friendship, all available to stream or rent at home right now. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is Andrew Stanton. I'm the director of films like Finding Nemo and WALL-E, and now John Carter, and you are listening to Film Spotting.
The time has come, Gypsy. You stand upon the brink of the abyss. Yet even now, it is not too late. I can save you from the flames of this world and the next. Choose me or the fire.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson. Tasha Robinson from The Dissolve is in for Adam this week. We'll get back into our top five Disney villains with that clip from The Hunchback of Notre Dame, a 1996 effort that doesn't usually rank among Disney's best, even from that decade. But Tasha, the voice we heard in that clip, the evil Judge Claude Frollo, is your number three. So what makes him stand out for you in the Disney canon?
Honestly, he might be my number one, if not for the fact that this movie is kind of relatively little seen. He doesn't have the iconicness of a lot of the characters that we're talking about. And the movie around him is really pretty flawed. But he himself, I think, is one of Disney's most fascinating characters of all time. He is the only Disney character I can think of, certainly, who is motivated primarily by lust and by religious guilt. This is a character who is, he opens the movie by running down and murdering a young woman with her baby in her arms and then moving to kill the baby as well. I mean, there's no level on which this is not an unadulterated villain.
This is a children's film we're talking about,
this
right?
This is a children's film we're talking about. You know, people think that The Black Cauldron is dark because, you know, it got the PG rating, but this movie is terrifying. There's a sequence in the middle of this film where Frollo, having been forced to take the baby whose mother he just murdered and adopt him and raise him, the baby is the Hunchback of Notre Dame. And when he sees the baby, he says, you know, he's deformed, he's a demon, he must die. But he's forced by his superior to take the child in and adopt him out of fear for his own soul, having committed this murder. So he raises him, but again, he manipulates him, he twists him. He gets more songs than most Disney villains. There's a song that he starts by saying, "You're ugly, you're deformed, you cannot come out into the world, everyone would hate you, I'm your only friend." And riding under "I'm your only friend" is, "And I hate you too." But what makes this villain for me is the sequence, the Hellfire sequence, where he sings about how he's fallen in love, well, in lust with the gypsy Esmeralda. And he calls upon, you know, the mother of God, basically, to come down and assist him by either cursing her and throwing her into hell or giving her to him.
Yikes.
Beata Maria, you know I am a righteous man. Of my virtue I am justly proud. Beata Maria, you know I'm so much purer than the common, vulgar, weak, licentious crowd. Then tell me, Maria, why I see her dancing there, why her smoldering eyes still scorch my soul. I feel her, I see her, the sun caught in her raven hair is blazing in me out of all control. Like fire, hellfire.
And then he goes on from there to basically say, curse her or give her to me. Those are your choices. He blames the woman for the fact that he's in lust with her. He blames the woman for the fact that he doesn't know what to do. And he blames the devil for tempting him. And he blames God for making the devil stronger than him. All wrapped up in this sequence. You can find it easily on YouTube, or you can just watch the movie. It's fantastic animation. But more so, it's an amazing evocation of this blend of religious hypocrisy that says, whatever I do is the right thing, whatever you do is the wrong thing, and I blame you for my transgressions. He is a fascinating villain. He's incredibly nuanced. And he's terrifying. So I really think that he's overlooked in the canon.
Yeah, in that scene, he lays out his religious credentials first, right?
Mm-hmm.
To then justify everything else he's going to do or wants to have happen.
And specifically to the Virgin Mary.
Right.
He starts what's ostensibly a prayer with, you know I'm awesome.
Uh-huh.
I know I'm awesome. Thanks for agreeing with me, lady. Now curse this lady.
Well, I'm infinitely more interested in checking Hunchback of Notre Dame out now, because you're right. It is one that I did never see originally and never felt the need to. But then again, I didn't know it was quite this weird. So we'll have to check that out. My number three is another minor character, I would probably say, not as iconic as a lot of these, Dr. Facilier. And this is the voodoo witch doctor from 2009's The Princess and the Frog. He facilitates the curses that turn the prince of the story and Tiana, the heroine, into frogs.
Lawrence, this remarkable gentleman has just read my poem.
Or this morning's newspaper.
Sire.
This chap is obviously a charlatan. I suggest we move on to a less...
Don't you disrespect me, little man. Don't you derogate or deride. You're in my world now, not your world. And I got friends on the other side.
That's an echo, gentlemen. Just a little something we have here in Louisiana. A little parlor trick, don't worry. Sit down at my table.
Facilier has the smooth talking baritone of Keith David, and visually, he at first appears fairly normal, if a bit untrustworthy. But then we notice that his shadow seems to have a life of its own. It's sort of like a more dangerous version of Peter Pan's here, and other characters even refer to him as the Shadow Man. Facilier also hangs out with an array of unnerving sprites and spirits that he calls his friends on the other side. He gets probably what's one of the creepiest scenes of comeuppance, I think, in the Disney canon when we do get to the climax of this film. He's not able to pull off this scheme that he had put into place, and the forces of evil he's cooperated with start to turn against him. There are hints of the darker parts of Beetlejuice here and a little bit of Nightmare Before Christmas as well. So for his creepy voodoo vibe, Dr. Facilier is my number three.
Man, the animation and the sequence in his villain song, you gotta love a good villain song. And his villain song, when he's surrounded by those things and he's singing about them, the animation there is just particularly spectacular.
Pretty psychedelic, yeah. Yeah. Who'd you have for number two, Tasha?
Well, speaking of villains with their own song, you know, the only thing better than Gaston with his I'm the Greatest song is this character who has the She's the Worst song. This vampire bat, this inhuman beast, she ought to be locked up and never released.
The world was such a wholesome place until Cruella, Cruella DeVille.
She's kind of the iconic image of the beautiful women are good in Disney and ugly women are bad. But she really owns her badness. She is the only person on my list who isn't a hypocrite, who isn't, you know, really about manipulation. She wants what she wants and she just goes for it. She goes for it recklessly and full throttle the way that she drives. She loves her fashion. She has certainly a signature look of her own. She's a hideous demon monster visually, but she's also got style, and I think you can't beat her.
Cruella, isn't that a new fur coat?
My only true love, darling. I live for furs. I worship furs. After all, is there a woman in all this wretched world who doesn't?
Yeah, that's great. You're right. She's pure in a similar way Maleficent is just driven towards one goal and doesn't mess around with manipulation or anything like that.
And that goal is to murder puppies.
Yes. Can't get much worse. All right. My number two is Ursula. Now, a lot of these villains foreshadow and hark back to each other. And speaking of Cruella de Vil, Ursula, who's the voluptuous, husky-voiced sea witch of The Little Mermaid, I think she's something like Cruella de Vil if Cruella had stopped smoking, maybe. She's filled out a bit, something of an overflowing vamp up top with this massive oily black tentacles on the bottom. Her husky voice, courtesy of Pat Carroll, clearly that of an ex-smoker. And more importantly, there's pure evil in her heart. The Disney animators, so often, they'll create character through the smallest of visual touches. And one of my favorites with Ursula is when she's at her underwater dressing table. She grabs a clam, I think it is, squeezes it until a little bit is squishing out of the shell, and then that's what she uses as lipstick. So there's cruelty right there. Overall, her lair, it's very much like a backstage dressing room, and you can easily imagine her headlining a nightclub. Now, like Dr. Facilier, Ursula uses the hero's dreams and desires against them. She convinces Ariel to give up her voice in order to become human. A lot of Disney villains, they kind of operate like payday loan scams in a way. You could almost call this subversive, I think. Sort of a nod to the dark side of granting wishes, even though granting wishes, of course, is Disney's bread and butter, except that those wishes are almost always still granted in the end. So it's maybe not so subversive, but even at face value, Ursula from The Little Mermaid, my number two.
Well, you've anticipated me, Josh. Ursula is my number one.
Your number one.
I don't know what she's doing on this list now that I think about it, because she's clearly not a villain. She's repented, seen the light, and made a switch. She fortunately knows a little magic. It's a talent that she always has possessed.
And dear lady, please don't laugh. I use it on behalf of the miserable, lonely, and depressed. Pathetic. Poor, unfortunate soul.
The second I started thinking about this list, that song hit me. Howard Ashman and Alan Menken brought so much to the Disney stable, and for me, this is one of their most powerful creations, is this particular song, Poor Unfortunate Souls, which lays out who Ursula is, what she wants, what she's planning to do, and then it does all of it. The whole song is a manipulation where she's grabbing hold of everything that Ariel wants and presenting it to her, and then she stacks the deck so hard. You know, she basically sets up a routine where she can't win. You know, in order to keep this gift that I'm giving you, you have to do this impossible thing. And I'm going to take away the thing that makes it possible for you to do this impossible thing. And then on top of that, I'm going to convince you that it's okay.
My voice?
You've got it, sweet cakes. No more talking, singing, zip.
But without my voice, how can I?
You'll have your looks, your pretty face. And don't underestimate the importance of body language. Ah, the men up there don't like a lot of blabber. They think a girl who gossips is a bore. Yet on land it's much preferred for ladies not to say a word. And after all, dear, what is idle prattle for? Come on, then, not all that impressed with conversation.
You know, as the song speeds up and builds towards a climax, and she tells Ariel, oh, on land it's much preferred for ladies not to say a word. It doesn't matter that I'm going to steal your voice. You'll be fine. Swish your hips at him. you'll get along. Just that sense of escalation as she stacks and stacks and stacks the deck is fabulous. But rewatching that sequence, the animation again is so spectacular. Like watching each one of her tentacles swirl around her as just this sort of like fabulous vamp looking, you know, a drag queen costume. Again, Disney loves their hidden drag queens. Ursula, I think, is one of the best, and she's my number one villain.
She's deserving of that spot because she probably is the most devious as you lay out the manipulation going on there. Great pick. Considered her for my number one, but I did end up going with Shere Khan. This is the man-eating Bengal tiger in 1967's The Jungle Book. And I think that detail right there, the man-eating part, it not only connects Shere Khan to our human world, so it makes us uncomfortable. Mm. Like, oh, I could get it with this character. I think it also positions him as a terrible threat to Mowgli, who is the young hero. Despite this fearsomeness, though, Shere Khan, as voiced by George Sanders, is given the polite manners of an English earl.
Yes, yes. Who is it?
It's me, Shere Khan. I'd like a word with you, if you don't mind.
Shere Khan. What a surprise.
Yes, isn't it?
So what you have here, again, is the quality of seductiveness. And the villain as seducer is a very common thread in Disney's Best Bad Guys. So they're not just evil, they're appealingly evil, which is even more disturbing. So the charming Shere Khan, that's my number one Disney villain. How about any honorable mentions? I know it wasn't a lot to choose from here, Tasha.
Oh, it certainly
but
felt like a lot to did, choose
it was,
from.
So there were hard choices.
Hard choices.
Yeah.
Yeah, leaving, I mean, Scar, I think, from The Lion King is a beautiful villain. He kind of is a later Shere Khan. The two of them, well, they wouldn't get along, but they look like cousins. They act like cousins. And he also has some of that languid, seductive, delicious malice.
Sure.
A lot of the characters who made my top five have a manic quality to them. Shere Khan and Scar, I think, have the laid-back fluidity of big cats, and they're both pretty fascinating. So Shere Khan, it was a hard choice leaving him off and made only a little easier by the fact I knew he was going to be on your list.
Okay.
Jafar, I think, is the other one that I think in the end he was edged out a little just because he doesn't have a song. You know, he doesn't have the big declaration of purpose. And there was actually a Howard Ashman Alan Menken song for him that's pretty good. It's on a set of like sort of lost Disney songs that includes all of the demos that they put together for the three films they did, but it would have slowed down the movie too much, so they cut it. So in the end, you know, he's scheming, he's fascinating, he's menacing, but he doesn't have the edge of, you know, the characters that get to declare themselves musically.
Yeah, it doesn't have the music.
What about you?
I considered certainly Cruella de Vil. I also did consider Scar and, you know, being, again, such a clear inspiration for Shere Khan. That's probably why he didn't make the list. The other one I thought about was Captain Hook. He's the villain as comic relief. As it doesn't have maybe that threat that I think these other ones have. At least I never felt that watching Peter Pan, but still an amusing villain nonetheless.
There's a little bit of menace to him.
Yeah.
When he's manipulating Wendy or when he's manipulating Tinkerbell, I think much as with Gaston and his like weird sexual threat, Disney can't quite get around the image of the older man menacing the younger girl. There's always going to be a little bit of sex in that.
Well, those are our top five Disney villains. Please send us your picks or any other comments you have about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail at 312-264-0744 or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
A few films we want to mention opening in limited release here in Chicago. Age of Uprising, The Legend of Michael Kohlhaas. This is a 16th century set historical drama. It stars Mads Mikkelsen. Also opening limited release, Words and Pictures. That features Clive Owen and Juliette Binoche as rival high school teachers. The big films opening in wide release. We have Edge of Tomorrow. Aliens throw Tom Cruise into a time loop, something like that. Doug Liman directs. It also features Emily Blunt. And The Fault in Our Stars, based on the best-selling YA novel. This is a romance between teens suffering from terminal cancer, stars Shailene Woodley, and gets Tasha's early seal of approval. Next week, Adam will be off again, so Michael Phillips returns for our belated review of James Gray's The Immigrant with Joaquin Phoenix. Marion Cotillard, and Jeremy Renner. We'll also share our top five movies about immigrants. Tasha, it was really great to have you back on the show. I know you've done it before. We've never done it together. I had a blast, especially talking animation. What can listeners look forward to reading from you over at The Dissolve?
Well, animation fans will probably want to check in on our coverage of Who Framed Roger Rabbit for its 25th anniversary.
That was great.
Every week at The Dissolve, we have a movie of the week that we kind of dive into with a bunch of different essays and pieces. And we just got through with that. Every week, we've got a new movie that we're talking about. And we cover both current movies and movies of the past that we love and hate. We also have our own podcast, The Dissolve Podcast, at the website. And you can find me on Twitter as Tasha Robinson, no space.
That's at thedissolve.com, so be sure to check that out. Thanks again, Tasha.
Thanks so much, Josh.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and to the members of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
That and more ahead on Film Spotting. That was beautiful.
That was fun.
Wow. All right. I knew we had the right person for this show.
Oh, thank you.